Sunday was the actual anniversary. Monday was the observed day of the arrival of Christopher Columbus on an island in the Caribbean. There's still some split on whether the day should be called Columbus Day, as it was for years, or Indigenous Peoples Day. We'll focus on the Indigenous people in this segment. California, big and diverse now, was once diverse in its populations of Native Americans. That changed in the 19th century as the young United States took up California as its own. Indigenous people could not be marched west as they were elsewhere, so many of them were killed. Benjamin Madley brings numbers and individual stories into his 2016 book, An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873. Ben Madley was born in Redding, raised in Karuk Country, and is now an associate professor of history at UCLA. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
We had a discussion of genocide earlier this week with Jeffrey Ostler, who I see is listed in your acknowledgments. He wrote Surviving Genocide. So same question. I mean, when does a series of events rise to the level of a genocide?
In order for a prosecutor to successfully convict someone of the crime of genocide, they essentially have to prove two points. First, intent to destroy a group in whole or in part that is national, ethnical, racial, or religious. And second, they have to commit one of five clearly defined genocidal crimes set forth in the United Nations Genocide Convention. And in my book, I'm primarily focused on the first crime, that is killing. So between 1846 and 1870 in California, the Indian population plunged from perhaps 150,000 individuals to just 30,000 survivors. And we know that diseases, dislocation, and starvation caused many of these deaths. But the near annihilation of the indigenous people of California was in fact genocide, sanctioned and facilitated by both California and federal officials.
Well, and then this is where the story gets interesting. I mean, the federal and California both involved in this. We'll get to the points in just a bit. I want to ask you about your own personal experience of growing up in Karuk Country, whether you spent much time among tribal members.
I did. So I grew up near a little town called Happy Camp. So I witnessed at first hand the conflicts over the local mine between Native people and newcomers over clear-cut logging, the damming of the Klamath River, and also more individual incidents like the consequences of driving while Indian.
So I'm guessing you were fairly young at the start of all this. I mean, as you came to realize how the Karuk people got to the place they occupy in the modern world, did this help drive you into the profession you're into?
Absolutely. Initially, I thought that the massacres and all of the violence might be localized to northern and northwestern California. But as I dug deeper into the archives, it became clear that this was a systemic statewide phenomenon.
There's a shortage of comprehensive works like yours, as you point out in your own book. It is a fairly grim history. But were you able to lay your hands on many primary sources that documented clearly what happened?
Absolutely. So it isn't that I discovered a secret trove of documents. It was rather the comprehensive moving through the archives. So initially, I started to see the legal system forcing California Indian people out of protection by and participation in the state legal system. So they were barred largely from testifying for or against whites in criminal cases. They were denied the right to serve as jurors. They were banned from being attorneys, and they were also banned from being judges. And at the same time, you could also see in the laws that there were a variety of laws passed that effectively legalized slavery of California Indian people during the 1850s and 1860s.
Legalized? I mean, slavery just in the same way that it was done in the South?
No, a bit different. So in 1850, they passed a law which allowed for the custodianship and wardship of California Indian people. And then in 1860, they extended that to allow for the legal indenture of any Indians. So there was both a trade that was illegal in human beings, but there was also the legal movement of California Indian people into situations of custody, wardship, and indenture. Literally by the thousands during this period.
And as you pointed out, when you can't be a lawyer, can't be a judge, can't represent yourself, you don't have any particular rights to state your case.
Exactly, exactly. And this unfree labor system had dire consequences. So, for example, here in Los Angeles, where I live, one of the famous lawyers of the 1850s recollected, and I'll quote for you, "Los Angeles had its slave mart, and thousands of honest useful people were absolutely destroyed in this way. And initially I thought that he might be exaggerating. And then I looked at the corroborating evidence from the U.S. Census Bureau and saw that between 1850 and 1870, L.A.'s Indian population, in fact, plummeted from 3,693 people to just 219.
Wow. The numbers are shocking every time I look at them. Now, some, as you point out, some deaths were due to disease and starvation, but do you have a fix on how many people died from violence over the period you cover in your book?
Yeah, so I think it's not at all an exaggeration to say that California state legislators established a state-sponsored killing machine. And what they did was governors called out or authorized 24 separate state militia expedition campaigns against California Indian people between 1850 and 1861. And these killed an absolute minimum of 1,340 California Indian people. They then paid for these 24 campaigns with a series of bond issues totaling over $1.51 million. So what's important about these state militia operations is not just many people that they killed, but that by demonstrating that the state of California would punish Indian killers, rather would not punish them, but rather reward them, militia expeditions helped to inspire vigilantes to kill an additional at least 6,460 California Indian people. But the federal government was also involved. The federal government, through congressional acts, directly reimbursed the state of California for almost all of those expenditures. And they also launched many of their own U.S. Army expeditions. And those U.S. Army expeditions killed at least 1,680 California Indian people during these years. So in total, we can see that the total death toll that is recorded is between 9,400 and 16,000 people, roughly. But those are very conservative, low-end estimates. And those are direct killings, so they don't take into account all of the people who died of exposure when they were fleeing from these hunter-killer groups going into difficult alpine environments or out into the deserts. And these figures also don't count all of the people who starved to death or were worked to death either on federal reservations in and outside of California or while the wards or indentures or custodians of non-Indian people.
Benjamin Madley, historian at UCLA, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can hear the depth of research that went into his 2016 book, An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call from Anne in Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. I am so glad that they are finally using the term genocide to describe what happened to the native peoples of North and South America. We have sugarcoated our history for so long, I would imagine that 95% of Americans think the only genocide that ever happened was what the Nazis did to the Jews in Germany. And our own history is replete with so many examples of killing of men, women, and children who just happened to be in the way of greedy settlers. And thank you for writing this book.
All right. Thanks for the call, Anne. I appreciate that. Ben Madley, and I should note that you've won several awards for this book, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for History, the Raphael Lemkin Book Award from the Institute for the Study of Genocide, and quite a few others. So you've been recognized for the elevation of the issue.
Well, one of the things that's really important that we have to understand is that the state endorsement of all of these killings and associated genocidal policies was only very thinly veiled. And that was one of the things that really surprised me as I got into the archives. For example, California's very first civilian elected governor, a man named Peter Burnett, who actually came from Oregon.
And was not a very good governor. We've talked about him on the program, too. Yeah.
There's a new biography of him that reveals some of his less savory actions.
Right.
And in 1851, in a public address to both houses of the legislature, he publicly declared that, and I quote, "A war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct. And I thought that perhaps that was a one-off. He said it right before he was forced out of office for some unsavory dealings. But the very next year, in 1852, United States Senator John Weller, who would become California's governor in 1858, went further. And he told his colleagues in the United States Senate, the California Indians, and I quote, will be exterminated before the onward march of the white men. And he argued that the interest of the white men demands their extinction. And if you read the newspapers from Northern and Central and Southern California and Southern Oregon, it's very clear that many newspaper editors agreed with this assumption that this was effectively a done deal.
Well, and that's the part that always gets me. I mean, we've talked on the program before about how enthusiastically the California newspapers cheered on the mistreatment and atrocities directed at Chinese people, but clearly they were at least as enthusiastic in the destruction of Native Americans.
Well, they were sometimes divided, if I can provide a slightly different perspective. So there were some purveyors of hate, like the Wairika Mountain Herald, were unequivocal in constantly, as you said, cheering on the process of genocide. But there were others, like the Daily Alta California, which was, in fact, the most widely circulated of all the California papers in the mid-19th century, which did a lot of hand-wringing and complained about the inhumanity of the process, but ultimately accepted it as a fait accompli, as something that was fated to happen. So one of the ideas that I talk about in the book is the myth that American Indian people were fated to vanish, and that this myth of inevitable extinction was very convenient because it allowed people to wash their hands of what they were actually doing. And so instead of thinking about the human hand being on the tiller, guiding the ship of state and guiding policy, it could be either the divine — there were some who saw this as a divine process — or it could be a natural process. So there was a lot of naturalizing of atrocity and genocide as something that nature was going to do.
So there's a certain level of romanticizing among white people. It's like, oh, the ways of the Indian are passing. But in fact, a lot of people were participating directly in it.
Right, right. But it's also, I think, important to understand that it's not just direct killing that are the acts of genocide here. There were scores of rapes and beatings, and these meet that United Nations Genocide Convention definition of causing serious bodily harm to victims on the basis of their group identity and with the intent to destroy the group. And the sustained military and civilian policy of demolishing California Indian villages, usually by burning them down and destroying their food stores, were driving the survivors into those inhospitable mountain and desert regions that I mentioned before, amounted to deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. So we get, for example, a U.S. military officer during the Civil War saying, I've killed a lot of people with the sword and the bayonet and the rifle, and the survivors are bound to perish by absolute thirst in the desert, which is where we've pushed them. And in addition, because malnutrition and physical exposure predictably lower the birth rate, some state and federal decision makers also appear guilty of imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And finally, that process of the slave trade that I mentioned before was, it's clearly defined in the UN Genocide Convention as forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And so by breaking up families and shattering whole communities, this also prevents births within the group. And thousands of people were caught up, ensnared in this unfree labor regime. Some scholars estimate at least 20,000 adults and perhaps 4,000 to 7,000 children as well.
Benjamin Madley is a historian at UCLA, born in Redding, raised in Happy Camp, the author of An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873. The book's been out about 3 years now. You can join our conversation here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The term pedagogic killing is brought up in your book. What does that mean?
Well, this is the idea that the killers thought that by killing, they would teach survivors not to do anything that they didn't want them to do. So, for example, when a cow would go missing from a local ranch, vigilantes might go out and state quite clearly in their journals or to journalists that interviewed them, they were going out to, quote unquote, teach Indians a lesson by massacring them. It's a very strange idea, but it is one that is a through line in the history of the United States, both before and after the colonial period, that colonists, whether they were Dutch or French or British, would often commit mass atrocities against indigenous people, thinking that they were somehow going to teach them a lesson by doing so.
I haven't talked about any specific incidents here, and a couple of incidents, a series of them around Clear Lake around 1850, apparently marked a turning point in relations between the Anglo settlers and the Native Americans. What happened?
So during a very short period of time, in response to the killing of two white slave owners on the shores of Clear Lake, first vigilantes, then the United States Army, launched a series of campaigns that killed perhaps 1,000 or more people between December of 1849 and May 15th of 1850. And when I was reading through all of the documents about these events, my expectation was that the officers who had carried these things out would be censured by their superior officers. But in fact, every single one of them received promotion as a result. And when one group of vigilantes arrested another group of vigilante killers, eight of these vigilante leaders were then tried in California's very first Supreme Court case, and all of them were let go on bail and never actually faced a trial. So what happened was that this was a turning point because it marked the beginning of sustained vigilante and federal Indian killing campaigns that were either allowed or actually supported by state and federal authorities.
Was there any point in the following 30 years when somebody white said, you know, this might not be right?
Yes, there were. And I really was at great pains to try to point out every single one of those people because they're so important to let us know that this is not something that was acceptable to everyone. There were church leaders and journalists and others who stood up for Indian people, but it was a very dangerous thing to do. There was a journalist who famously wrote a piece describing the Humboldt Bay massacres in vivid detail, and he actually had to flee town at threat of being lynched because he had exposed who was involved and what was happening, and he could no longer remain there.
The map that you show in the book of all the original areas that were occupied by certain peoples and their linguistic groups is fascinating, particularly for the heavy cluster around the Humboldt Bay region and just how many different groups by name there were there. I mean, the number of Native Americans living in California in 1880 is shocking. It's even lower than what you report for 1873. Were some people just wiped out completely? Were they gone forever, their languages too?
You know, I thought that some peoples had been wiped out completely, but part of my research process was to visit California Indian rancherias, colonies, reservations, and communities in Oregon, California, and Oklahoma. And I found that a lot of the so-called vanished peoples do in fact exist. I met them, and there are people who are culture bearers and still speaking the language. And one of the really remarkable parts of this story is the tale of survival. So this dark cloud of genocide hangs like a specter over California history, but the silver lining is the story of California Indian survival against almost impossible odds. The main focus of this book is less on that story of survival and more on the mechanics of the building and maintenance and funding of this killing machine, because I thought that this is a story that has never been told, and this is the first part of it. But I'm now working on a project that's more about California Indian survival and how that happened, because when you think about trying to preserve women, children, men, elders, when there are relentless U.S. Army and vigilante and militia campaigns coming after you, it's quite remarkable that people were able to do this. It was not only that they had the knowledge of the land, but it was also an incredible tenacity, a willingness to undergo tremendous hardship in order to survive.
In the 3 years since your book came out, I mean, have you gotten a lot of responses? Does the story seem to be sinking in and people are getting the enormity of what happened in California?
Well, one of the really interesting things that happened was that then-Governor Jerry Brown read the book very soon after it came out, and we entered into a series of conversations, and I actually was able to give a book presentation at the state capitol. And after he read the book, he became the first U.S. governor to publicly acknowledge a series of massacres that constituted genocide. So he acknowledged that this was, and I quote, an actual genocide. And then subsequent to that, the current governor of California, Gavin Newsom, earlier in this summer, issued a public apology, and more recently has actually stated that this material, the history of this 1846 to 1873 genocide, ought to be included in the state educational standards. So there are a number of projects ongoing, some of which I am a part, to rewrite and rethink the California educational standards in order to include some of this information. And in addition, working with Jerry Brown and others in Sacramento, we're starting a digital atlas of California Indian people, which California's 109 federally recognized tribes, as well as its scores of state recognized and unrecognized tribes, will be able to contribute to. So some of the material in the book, for example, the 200 pages of appendices, which enumerate all of the violence quantitatively and all of the expenditures to fund it, will become available to the public in an online platform so that people can learn more about the history of their tribal nation, the history of their county or the municipality where they live, and to provide a powerful teaching tool for local educators.
Well, it's not an easy story to take in, but it's one we need to know. And it's well documented in the book, An American Genocide, the United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873. It's the work of Benjamin Madley, born in Reading, raised in Happy Camp, and now working at UCLA as a historian. Thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
All right, take care. That'll do it for this segment of The Exchange. Short break, and then back with Marketplace Tech and Underground History.